HMS Jonathan Mosen here.
I'm well, thanks. I appreciate you giving up some time. Are you on a speakerphone by any chance? You're a little faint and a bit sort of bathtub sounding. Yeah, that's not too bad. Hopefully you'll be able to hear me alright when we go to air, because I'll be a little bit fainter as well. Okay, that's fine. I'll just get set up here and be with you in a couple of minutes.
If you're a modem user and you live in the United States, now you can have quality, reliable internet access and support ACB radio at the same time. Easy Access USA gives you flat rate 56K internet access, 2 email accounts, and Usenet news groups for only $19.95 a month. And every month, $4 of that great price goes to ACB Radio, so we can keep bringing you your favorite shows and expanding our service. So don't delay. Switch today to Easy Access USA. Surf on over now to www.easyaccessusa.net. That's www.easyaccessusa.net. Or if you'd rather sign up over the phone, call them toll-free at 866-835-7872. That's 866-835-7872 between 8 a.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern. Easy Access USA and ACB Radio, working together to bring you the best.
Hey, you know what this is? That is yours truly, the Snowman, actually snoring during my own most recent attempt at a talk show. Not precisely a violation of policy, but not exactly captivating programming either.
This is not working out.
Well, what exactly isn't working?
Oh, man, you name it.
I think I need professional help, and I need the best I can get.
That's why I got on the phone and called him.
Hi, this is Mike.
He's Mike Bullis, and while we're not sure how professional he is, he was the best I could get. And he's funny. And when he's jazzed up on a couple of cups of coffee, you cannot keep up with him.
What on God's earth have I done?
I'm not really sure I can, but we're going to give it a try. So you want to do a talk show, Mike?
Yeah, bring it on.
All right, let's do it.
I'm kind of worried about the callers we're going to get.
Why?
what kind of questions do you think they're going to ask us?
I don't think they're questions a clever guy like you can't wiggle out of. It'll be a lot of fun, and we'll try to do some substantive conversation as well along the way.
No, I think it'd be fun.
Guaranteed, and we'll have the Spiderphone connection available so people can join us.
What time are we going to do this thing?
Well, it's 9 o'clock Eastern Time on Monday nights, U.S. That's 0200 GMT Tuesday. Can you be there?
Yeah.
Good man, and we'll figure out what to call the program later.
Okay.
Bullis and the Snowman, GMT Tuesdays at 0200 on ACB Radio Mainstream.
For the blind, by the blind, ACB Radio.
Happy New Year to you. Welcome. This is Blind Line on ACB Radio Mainstream, the original live talk show exclusively for the blind and vision impaired. It's Jonathan Mosen, and hopefully I can still remember how to drive all this stuff. It's been a wee while. It's been a month. I've had a wonderful summer break, and I can tell you some more about that a bit later. But most importantly, we have a fascinating guest on the show today. He is Jim Thatcher. He's a name who will be familiar to many of you if you've been following the assistive technology industry for a while. He's most renowned for his involvement with IBM, the development of screen reader for DOS and OS 2, but more recently he's been working as an independent web consultant. He's been involved in the designing of that very significant set of regulations pursuant to Section 508 of the Rehab Act, and a lot of other things as well. So I'm sure we'll have a fascinating chat with Jim Thatcher, and if you would like to participate, you can call in at any stage during the program. All you need to do to participate is call us courtesy of spiderphone.com. The number is in the United States, and it's area code 212-812-2800. If you're using Winamp or RealPlayer, you should see that in the title bar of your window for your player, 212-812-2800. And when Spiderphone asks you to enter a conference code, the numbers to enter are 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. Without any further ado, Jim Thatcher, very good evening to you.
and good evening to you, Jonathan.
Nice to have you with us. We appreciate it. Let me go back to the beginning of your involvement with Access, because you're a PhD graduate. You did some interesting work in electrical engineering and artificial intelligence. Then you got on to the assistive technology track. Can you tell us a bit about how that happened?
Sure. I got my degree at Michigan, and my thesis advisor is Jess Wright, Dr. Jesse Wright, who is blind, and he and I together left Michigan and went to IBM in 1963, and we did basically computer science and mathematics together for about 20 years, from 63 to 83, and then he got interested in using a computer instead of theorizing about it, and that's how it all started, working with him and later others in IBM who were blind.
It's fascinating that many of the big players in assistive technology have been inspired to do some work in this field because of blind people that they personally knew.
I hardly know of any that for whom that didn't happen. There's one exception that I know of. I'm sure there are others that I like to talk about, and that is, the guy who invented Al Overby, the guy who invented the talking 3270 terminal.
All right.
Which came out in about 1973 or 4, I think, and it ended up being an IBM product. And he did that. It was a huge Voltrax box, about the size of a suitcase, attached to a 3270 terminal and a keypad. And he did that, and he had no interaction, apparently, before or even after, with anyone who was blind, which is an interesting story.
Yeah, they were amazing pieces of hardware, those Voltrax devices.
They were incredible, and there are a lot of people who were blind and got into using computers for the first time because they were able to do mainframe computing. It was a text-based thing, and so it was relatively easy to do.
Did your work in artificial intelligence in any way assist the work that you did in terms of blind access?
No, I didn't do any work in artificial intelligence. I spent a year at the University of Edinburgh in the Department of Machine Intelligence, School of Artificial Intelligence, but I basically was doing theoretical computer science at that time. I wasn't doing AI.
Okay. By the time that IBM got involved in the development of a screen reader for DOS, the market was reasonably crowded, I guess you could say. What was the inspiration behind IBM's involvement in this area?
The way you can make things happen, is to push. I remember I had this thing which we called, they were called audio access systems. They weren't called screen readers in those days. And there were only, when screen reader DOS was being developed between Jess and myself and about 20 people who were blind in IBM, there was no plan to make it a product. And we would go to internal conferences and advocate among other people with disabilities about things that ought to be done within IBM, because IBM could have the resources to actually make products. And eventually, make products for disability, obviously to make products. Some person in Boca Raton, Florida, in the PC business, said, this sounds like a really good idea. And basically, he bought into the idea of making screen reader a product. And I remember that was about 1984, and I remember in 1985 when the team down in Boca Raton, I was up in New York, had picked a name for this product. It was called PCSED internally. The reason it was called PCSED, we're getting a little, we're folding back on ourselves here. The reason it was called PCSED is Al Overby's talking terminal was called SED before it became a product.
Right.
And this is the PC version of SED. SAID stands for Synthetic Audio Interface Device. Anyway, I remember when the planning team down in Florida came up with this name for PC said, and the name they chose was Screen Reader. And I thought, oh God, that's really awful. It turned out to be a pretty good choice of name.
It's now sort of become the standard term that we use for any such product.
Yeah, it's like the Kleenex of the industry.
Yeah, or Xerox.
Xerox, right. Yeah.
That sort of thing. What interests me about the development of screen reader is that, of course, we're talking about the days where PC-DOS was around, which was an IBM product. These days, although you have Narrator in Microsoft's operating systems, Microsoft has always been against the idea of developing a fully-fledged screen reader that's built into Windows. Do you think that blind people are well-served or not so well-served by that kind of a decision?
Well, I think that's an excellent decision. I think that's the right thing. I think I'm sure that there are people who are opposed even to the idea of having Narrator on the new operating systems of Microsoft. The advocacy that comes from firms like GW Micro and Freedom Scientific and others, that's terribly important. The concentration is entirely for people who are blind. And when you have a product coming out of a company like IBM or Microsoft, those issues end up getting diluted, I'm afraid. So I think it's important that these smaller companies who really have the needs of blind customers in their mind are the ones that are doing the screen reading.
Some people would counter that by saying that what we really desperately need is a universally accessible operating system so that no matter where you go on what computer you're on, you can immediately fire it up and have absolutely 100% effective access to the operating system. Isn't that a pretty compelling argument?
It's a compelling idea. I mean, no, it's not. It's a wonderful idea. And I have dreams, too. We could talk about those, I guess. I mean, it's a fantasy. Screen readers are too difficult for that to be practical. There's too much like artisanry. I mean, it's an artistic thing. There are heuristics, there are tricks, and that's the way screen readers work. And I think that the hope that you will have the kind of technology that you imagine, that is an operating system that essentially was accessible from any place you turned it on, so to speak, I think it's just almost, it's impossible to imagine. There's too much that has to be specifically, for example, tailored to specific applications. Screen reader is just, Narrator works because it just does menus and simple dialogues and doesn't have to worry about what applications do. I mean, I know screen readers are really important when they start worrying about what is going on in the actual application. And Narrator doesn't worry about that.
So just go back and talk a little bit about that first screen reader for DOS. Looking back on it, you're still pretty proud of the way that stacks up in terms of the quality of that kind of software?
Yes, I think yes, it's... In retrospect, I basically would have sold it differently. See, screen reader for DOS and later for OS 2, its strength came in what we call the profile language. And basically, you could completely program how the screen reader worked. And what we sent were samples of that. When you bought the product, you bought profiles that were kind of the defaults that we had written. And the idea is that anybody could do that. Well, it's too hard to do. And so... in retrospect, I think we should have had fewer options and developed more the profile technology to work out of the box rather than hoping people would do their own profiles. It was too complicated, I think. You had to be a programmer. Very few people did that.
And yet, when you did profile an application for screen reader, man, it really could sing, couldn't it?
Yeah, Zing. It was incredible. And it was a lot of fun to do, actually, writing those profiles.
Yeah.
I haven't done that in many years. There was a question recently about the profile language, and I don't know. I don't remember.
Gosh. So it's still out there, is it? Did Screen Reader for DOS ever get released into the public domain or anything like that?
And you mean did it ever become freeware?
Yes.
Is that your question? No. It didn't, unfortunately. It certainly should have. I think it's that is probably very hard for a huge company like IBM to do. They're worried about, I'm guessing, they're worried about legal ramifications and support and all that other stuff. I hope that somebody would have the idea actually in this call to offer to take Screen Reader 2 and Screen Reader for DOS and make them available for free.
It'd be a wonderful initiative.
What has to happen is somebody has to propose that.
Yes.
I don't know if it's worth anything to anybody, actually, so maybe it's a bad idea. Maybe it's a bad idea to even talk about bringing it into freeware. It's waste somebody's time.
Interesting, because there are still people who have called for a screen reader for DOS, and I know that there's been a lot of enthusiasm since JAWS went freeware, that people still want to get to that command prompt, which won't be there.
I didn't hear what you said. Since JAWS went...
JAWS has gone freeware for DOS.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, and so people have found that quite an attractive proposition for those who want to get to the command prompt. Can we talk about Screen Reader for OS 2? Because that came out at a time when many of us were feeling very despondent about the clearly graphical direction in which the computer industry was heading and the degree to which that was going to jeopardize employment and our ability to access information and communicate. And then you came along with Screen Reader for OS 2, which is still regarded by many as one of the best access that we've ever had to the graphical user interface.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think I was... I remember talking at ACB and the other organization about saying that really there's the potential here to be much better off, because I had just gone through this process of trying to tailor write profiles for DOS applications, which had menus. Remember, they started having menus and windows.
Yeah. Mm.
They had stacked windows that would come out on top of each other, and profiles for them were really, really difficult. And all of a sudden, control information was immediately available to the screen reader, and simply available. So it was an incredible improvement over what we were trying to make accessible in the DOS world. Things have changed to make it more difficult, but it's always a struggle.
And by this stage, what was happening in the DOS world anyway was that a number of applications were being written that put you into graphical mode. So the text-based screen readers for DOS just couldn't cope with those applications anyway.
Yeah, as soon as they went to graphics mode, then all of us in the DOS world were broken. But I think even staying in text mode, I remember some of the IBM, what was it called? Display Writer and Easy Writer is wrong, but they really looked like Windows applications, except they were purely in text mode, and they were DOS text mode, but they looked like Windows applications, and those were terrible to try to uncover, to try to make accessible, and so it was actually very exciting to move into the graphical user interface, because we saw that really all we needed to do was get that information that rests mainly in the client area of an application. It's the work area. It's the place where you actually do something. All the stuff on the outside, all the dialogues and all the menus, and were fundamentally accessible. So we really had to, we're able to boil down the problem to one of getting access to that center information, the real work area.
I think we got ourselves into a mindset that said that if it's graphical, therefore it's got to be inaccessible and it's got to be bad. And it took us a long time to think a bit more laterally about things.
Yeah, and that's kind of interesting. The trick, of course, was we know that everything that goes on the screen is text before it actually gets turned into graphics. And that's why we knew it was possible. And I'm sure that I don't know anything about the current GDI Plus or GDI 2 or whatever it's called that Microsoft's talking about. But all of a sudden, the red flag is up again, because this is a case where developers can use with this new interface in Windows, Windows XP, and I think mainly, that you can write directly to the screen. And as soon as you do that as an application, the screen reader is not going to know anything about it, and we're back to ground zero again. So it's an interesting comparison. The reason we knew that the graphical user interface was going to work is this idea that everything is text before it ends up being pixels. And we all we need to do is find the right place to pick it up and as text. And that's basically what the screen readers have done for the graphical user interface since that, about 87 or 88, something like that. But when applications start writing directly to the display, it's very much like those DOS screen readers that threw up their arms when the program went graphics, because the screen reader doesn't know anything about the stuff that gets written directly to the display.
Was OS 2 a fairly easy operating system to get under the hood of to hook into for screen reader?
No, it wasn't easy. It's a nice story. It isn't a nice story. It's a bad story, actually. The key was looking basically in at the display device driver level. So the screen reader got to see everything that was being requested by applications before it got sent off to the display device driver to put on the screen. And we had, by cajoling the developers in Boca Raton, we had convinced them that we could really do something exciting by intercepting these calls, and they would tell us all about how we could do that. But it was all a hack. It was really something that you couldn't. I then would never allow a product to go out with this kind of hacking going on. But we couldn't get the development community to support us in any architected way, because that would cost money. Well, it turned out that there was another project called the forgotten what it's called, but it's basically an application that will display one person's computer remotely on another computer. There are lots of things like that today. But it had needed exactly the same hooks that we needed. So we teamed up with that application and architected the hooks that we needed and put them into OS 2. And as far as I know, it's the only time really that the hooks for a screen reader were, in fact, architected into the system rather than being kind of hacking procedures.
We've got a call, so we'll take that and then we'll come back and talk about this some more. Area code 631, your question for Jim Thatcher, please.
Good evening, Jonathan.
Hi there, Richard. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just was kind of curious. I know recently that Sun Microsystems, Java, they had said that they had, especially in the new Palm tops, that they were developing an actual, not so much a screen reader, but a actual speech engine, which I guess could be eventually put into a screen reader. What do you think about those recent developments as far as even also getting speech into the Palm Top?
Mm-hmm. Is that a question for Jonathan or me?
For you, sir.
I know nothing about that. So I think it would be terrific to get speech into smaller devices, and I'm sure it'll be there soon, because it's just a matter of those smaller devices getting more power. I don't know what Sun's doing about putting speech into Palm Top. I know nothing about it.
Yeah. Okay. It's actually very. I think it was just they just talked about it within the last month or so, supposedly about this speech engine and the fact that they didn't how they were adapting it to actually be so that you wouldn't have to actually have to use a pen or even a small quirky keyboard. You could actually talk to your PC, and not your PC, but your Palm Top, and actually have it do some things. So I was just wondering if it was anything along those lines as far as screen development technology, especially with Java.
Well, first of all, I suspect that they recognize that the market is in speech recognition and not in, because input devices are, input is a problem with Palm Top, right? So they're talking about speech recognition primarily. Well, if you can do speech recognition, you probably almost certainly have enough power to do speech synthesis. And now if you're using Java in the most recent incarnations, in the Java Foundation classes, the Java Swing set components, then those, in principle, are accessible components. In other words, you could write self-voicing applications on the Palm Top, on your Palm that were running in Java and speaking through the speech engine. It would be an interesting effort. It would be interesting to see.
Well, that's what they said that they have done. I don't remember the article, unfortunately. It was, like I say, it was about a month or so ago when they had announced it. As they even had new tools to develop the technology. It was fairly new technology that Sun was developing.
Sounds good. I wish they'd take that same technology and put it into a mobile phone. And,
yes.
Have it talk. I mean, for crying out loud, it'd be easy enough.
Absolutely. Good question. Thanks for phoning in, Richard.
Be able to do that because, I mean, the phone itself already has plenty of power in it to start with as far as its web capability and all. And it just seems like the chip is out there.
Right.
Absolutely. Thanks for your call, Richard. We'll catch up again.
Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye now. We're speaking with Jim Thatcher on Blind Line. If you would like to join us, the phone number is area code 212-812-2800. You'll find that in the title bar of your media player, 212-812-2800. And the conference code is 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. Do you think that the fact that IBM developed Screen Reader for OS 2 acted as a disincentive to other screen reader developers to get into the OS 2 game as well?
Yes, I think yes, absolutely. Of course, it didn't act as a disincentive for Microsoft to get into the graphical user interface area at all.
Yeah, to what do you?
It was sarcasm there.
It actually does lead very nicely into my next question, which is that to what do you attribute the? I hope you don't think failure is too strong a term, of OS 2 to really gain significant market share and Microsoft to get such dominance through Windows.
I don't really attribute that. I don't know how they attribute it. I don't know why. It's OS 2 is a better operating system than Windows, and I guess I attribute it to marketing. I think that Microsoft and IBM waged war, and it was on the operating system arena, in the operating system arena, and the war was fought basically in marketing, and Microsoft is extremely good at that.
Yeah, clearly.
That's why we have Windows today and don't have OS 2.
Do you think that, in retrospect, it would have been good for IBM to do a version of Screen Reader for Windows at a time when we were crying out for good quality Windows access?
Yes, in retrospect, I definitely think we should have done that. At some point, the Accessibility Center made the decision, or it was called then the Special Needs Center, Special Needs Systems it was called, that the organization that put out Screen Reader DOS and Screen Reader OS 2, at some point there was a decision made to not go for a Windows, especially an NT screen reader, and basically to work on Java instead. I think that was the decision, if I remember it correctly. And I think that was a mistake in retrospect. I wish we had done NT screen reader, but I don't know. The companies that are doing it are doing such a good job of it. I'm not sad that we didn't do it.
Well, I only had the briefest of plays with OS2 and screen reader running on it, but it's been said to me in preparation for this interview by a couple of people that in their view the quality of the access that you were offering to the GUI through Screen Reader 2 is comparable to what we're getting in Windows right now.
I think that's right. I think that's right. There's a crucial... crucial is wrong. I think the fact that we decided that we're going to have this keypad... Now, the keypad was a deal that you either hated it or, for those people who used it, loved it. And the reason that was wonderful is that you're extricated from having to worry about these complex, incredibly complex key chords doing even the simplest things. And so you had this keypad. And that, I think, freed up the developers of Screen Reader to focus on things that are really important, function, and how to bring that function up to the, basically, to the profile language. It really was a very modularized development. And I think there are things that are, and I know that JAWS now has a configuration language, but not of the quality that was in 3Meter 2. And I think a lot of the function that was in 3Meter 2 at its peak is just now coming into the other 3Meters.
Yeah, it's fascinating, all right. It seems to me there's a bit of a gap in my history of what the Special Needs System Division were doing, really, between the Screen Reader 2 days and the instigation of Homepage Reader. What was going on there between those years?
I'm trying to... Oh, dear. In terms of assistive technology, I guess that was... I'm trying to remember when the last version of OS2 Screen Reader came out. But there are other products in other areas.
Right.
I'm having a mental block on it. The phrase that people use for this product I'm trying to remember is teaching deaf children to speak. Speech Viewer is what it's called. And I think there was a development of Speech Viewer, a major product in between OS2 Screen Reader days and Homepage Reader days.
Okay. Let's talk about Homepage Reader. It came out, even in its early versions, at a time when we were starting to get quite good access to Windows and MSAA was coming through with Internet Explorer. Why Homepage Reader? What did IBM see as the value in putting resources into that product?
Like all these... efforts within IBM, they're usually, like a number of assistive technology efforts within IBM, they're usually coming from somebody. And the somebody in this case is Chieko Asakawa in IBM Japan. And she wasn't seeing any good access to Windows in Japan. And she saw a terrific need for being able to ordinary people who are blind being able to get the newspaper using the Internet. And so that focus was the focus that created Homepage Reader. And it was actually released in Japanese before it was released in English. And I think that's the first. I don't know of any technology that came out in any software technology that came out in Japanese before English. And I believe also with every edition of Homepage Reader that it's still coming out ahead of what screen readers are doing for the Internet.
As somebody who's been involved in interface design, I wonder if you have a view on the fact that really that the leading screen readers these days appear to have abandoned the idea of reading the screen when it comes to programs like Internet Explorer, where they're able to render the HTML into a buffer and reorganize the text so that it is presented in a linear fashion that makes more sense to us as blind people. But they're not reading the screen. Is that... do you have a philosophical problem with that, or is the bottom line that people get the information in the best way they can?
That's the bottom line. There's no question about it. It is interesting that as we talk about screen readers and the origin of that phrase, that in fact the new, the evolution today is away from screen reading. It's into object models and MSAA and object models for both for internet and for other applications. So more and more, the applications are the screen, the assistive technology is getting at the same information that the application uses to do the displaying. It's much better. You get it before it's been watered down by the display process. The difficulty is if the application can do things kind of disobeying the rules, so to speak, and whether it's MSAA or model, that could often be the case that the application is doing something not sticking to the rules, and therefore, because the screen reader isn't reading the screen anymore, it's not going to know what happened, and that's our worry. That to be the worry for this new generation of system technology.
It's also an issue, I suppose, if you are in the field of perhaps working with colleagues in an office situation, or maybe you're seeking to train others who are sighted in the use of a particular product, that screen readers are getting so sophisticated with the way they use object models now that you could potentially be presented with an entirely different interface to that application.
I can't think of an entirely different interface, but I don't see how that could happen.
Well, I guess the example I'm looking at is, for example, Microsoft Word and screen readers like JAWS, or JAWS in particular. There are keystrokes in there that actually perform, I guess, more of a macro function rather than a screen reading function, so that there's a blur that the user is almost not clear what's a screen reader command performing a whole series of shortcuts for you and what's a command that belongs to the application. And so you may well think that a command belongs to the application that you can instruct a sighted person to perform, when in fact it doesn't.
Yes, yes, you're right. I now I understand what you're saying. And that was true of Screen Reader 2, that we could put things, we could interact with the application in ways that basically could be ones that weren't available to the sighted user of that application. It's an interesting difference. Makes it fun for the developer and the user. A little confusing when in that communication situation you were talking about, where what the blind user is seeing is different than what the sighted colleague is to see.
I don't know what the solution is, or whether it's even that much of a big deal, but it's an interesting thing to ponder.
It is.
Yeah. As I was looking at your background and putting some questions together, I couldn't help pondering, and you may well feel unable to comment on this, but IBM has done so much in the area of accessibility. It's been very proactive, and yet it through the whole business with the Olympic Games website that it was in charge of in 2000 fell seriously foul of the Australian disability law by designing an exceedingly inaccessible site. There's a real irony, an oxymoron in that.
No, it isn't. You have to know, and you do know, and one has to remember that when you talk about the accessibility group at IBM or the accessibility group at Microsoft, for that matter, they are very small groups relative to their corporate population, and they're the ones that develop Microsoft Active Accessibility or Homepage Reader and advocate for accessibility within their company. And they're always going to be on our side, if you follow me. But they are not the whole company. And so it's some part of a huge company that contracts with the Olympic Committee and develops a site that is terribly inaccessible. And when that's recognized, indeed, the Accessibility Center and IBM will get involved, but they don't, you see, they don't control the company. So It is an oxymoron. It's a fact of life that the accessibility teams in these large companies, whether it's Sun or IBM or Adobe or Microsoft, try very hard to change companies. Well, those companies have very powerful development managers that don't want to release a single minute of time for accessibility, and the task accessibility team has is trying to figure ways to bring this huge company around to do it the right way, and it didn't work in the Olympic case, and it didn't certainly may not be working in the Microsoft GDI thing that I mentioned before of writing directly to the screen.
And we need.
But that's the thing you have to remember. I think that the accessibility teams are on the right side of the issue, but they may not have convinced everybody in these large companies to do it the right way.
And we're never going to win that argument on market force issues alone, because we're just not large enough. Does that mean that the only solution is to lobby for the implementation of regulations such as 508?
Yeah, well, when you said market forces alone, I wrote that down, because indeed I believe that 508 is market force, and I think that I know better what IBM has done over the last 3 or 4 years in response to what they perceive 508 means to them, and basically that's taking accessibility seriously at all levels of the company, and they're going to be failures. Or I have no doubt about that. But because it's believed that you can't have two sets of products, one for the government and the other for the rest of us, which of course the people who advocated 508 knew that companies wouldn't do that. So the reason for advocating 508, even if it's just covering the purchases, is that companies will then make their stuff accessible in general because you don't want to have two sets of products. Indeed, I think that IBM has really taken accessibility very seriously in the last 3 or 4 years, and I believe that 508 is a very, very important part of that picture.
We have an international audience, but one thing I've been mindful of in the last few months, even here in New Zealand, is that 508 is having a worldwide impact because of the amount of software people tend to buy from the United States. It's amazing what's trickling down.
Yes, I think that's right. And also, we're seeing more and more states looking to 508 as a way of the writing for 508 as a way of establishing what are the rules for accessibility, and I think that the companies will do that as well. So it's having an international organization. Other countries are looking to what was written for 508 in terms of accessibility. So I think it's a very positive development.
Do we need further time before we can really assess how effective those 508 regulations are, or are you prepared to go on record as saying they're a big success?
I think both. I think it's a big success, and we sure need more time. Both. There's a big difference between Section 508 and the web, because I guess it's because the web is what it is. There's a tremendous amount of information available about how to make web applications and websites accessible, and whether you read 508 or whether you read the Web Accessibility Initiative guidelines, there's a lot of information available. But there's another. We spend our time not wholly on the web. There's, as you know, there's software and there's telecom and all these other things, and there's very little information that's been developed that supports 508 for the non-web stuff, and that's where we need to. That's where we have to wait and see how that's going to play out. Because I think companies need more help in articulating the ways that they can make their software, the telecom, and hardware products accessible.
That's an interesting issue, because somebody raised this on another program that we did, that they began some dialogue with an author of an application that had a few problems with their screen reader, and the author was very helpful. And the author said, well, where can I go to find out what steps need to be taken to design an accessible piece of software, one that works well with screen readers? And you immediately think of the W3C when you talk about the web, and there are, as you say, a whole lot of options. I can't think of a particular place you can go to point software developers to get a few simple instructions about the difference between custom controls and standard Windows controls, etc.
Yes, I think I could list 8 or 10 solid sources for web accessibility. You mentioned W3C. I think the web course that I did for the ITAC, the Information Technology Technical Assistance and Training Center, that's a mouthful. The guides from the Access Board, there are just a lot of them. But for that software developer, especially if that software developer is not in Windows, there's very little. But the only, two sources I point people to are the IBM guidelines. That's the Accessibility Center coming through again. IBM guidelines for software and hardware and notes and Java and other technologies are very, very good. And, of course, Microsoft has a very large document on building accessible Windows applications, which is serious stuff. And it's huge. So those are the resources, but they're not the kind of I just did a contract for a large electronics company on rationale and design requirements and testing requirements for the software area. And it's really, really hard to find that information.
Yep, okay, that's interesting. You're involved in a lot of web consultancy as well, in terms of making websites accessible. It seems to me that there's a bit of tension between universal access and the concept of a page that uses the latest technology like Java, but is accessible to people with disabilities using modern browsers and screen readers. Do you think that's correct? Are we talking about two different things? Do we need to make a clear distinction between universal design and an accessible site with modern technology?
I think I want to ask you, I don't understand that question. I think there's an issue, there are questions about how do you make your website, if it's using HTML, how do you make it accessible? And most sites are pretty bad on that basic level, and that's what most of our information that's available talks about.
Hmm. I suppose that what I'm getting at is that if you put a web page that's full of Java that reads perfectly well with the latest homepage reader or JAWS or WindowEyes, I mean, you just can't tell it's using Java, then a lot of these accessibility tools will howl at you because you're using Java, and obviously if you run it under Linux, it's not going to work. That's the kind of difference I'm trying to get at, that using IE6 and a good screen reader or homepage reader, that page is going to read fine. It's just not going to read fine in older browsers.
We've got a difference of opinion here. If you have Flash or Java on your web page, it's not going to read fine with homepage reader, and I don't think it's going to read fine with JAWS either. It depends on the nature of the Java to some extent, but it might be that if you had exactly the right version of the Java bridge, Windows bridge, not Windows bridge, the bridge between Java and Windows, that you might get something from the Java application running. Very poor.
Yeah, sorry, I should have made a clearer distinction. I certainly agree with you about the Flash, by the way. I was referring to JavaScript as opposed to a Java.
Oh, that's different.
Right.
That's a very common and understandable, not, I don't even want to say confusion.
Right.
Because one's called Java and the other's called JavaScript. and hey, they're not related, but they sure sound related, right?
Yeah, so I've been on holiday and I'm being a bit lax. So that's my point, that a well-written JavaScript site will read fine with IE6 in a screen reader and won't make any sense in links. And so that's the point I'm trying to make about the differentiation between universal design and accessibility.
Now, do you take universal design to... See, I really don't like universal design because I think there's so many of the things that we need to do for people who are blind that are not useful to anybody else. Like the way you need to label form elements. It's specifically for screen readers. Nothing universal about it. So I don't like universal design, but that's an aside. I believe, along with the access board, that something so important and popular as JavaScript, the issue has to be do JavaScript accessibly. Don't mess around. Don't do things that don't work with screen readers. So and as far as the older browsers are concerned, sorry, the entire web is going to dynamic HTML. And if that's JavaScript and if it's done well, it is accessible with current system technology. And so that's good. And that's where we should be. Universal design means it has to work also with links. It's not going to happen because links is not going to have an object model with which to interact, which is what JavaScript needs to do.
W3C has a different view, though, doesn't it? Or does it?
It sure does. Right. Right. They view that supporting older browsers and older technology is important, and I understand that view. I just don't agree with it.
And but there is a kind of a view out there that W3C is somehow the ultimate arbiter on these things.
I would think that 508 is more ultimate right now, given that it's got the force of law behind it, and it's the Section 508 that companies are listening to today. That's W3C.
Well, that's very interesting to hear you say that, because I felt like I've been a bit of a lone voice arguing on this for a wee while, certainly in this part of the world. Let's talk about... we talked about this briefly, I think, when Richard phoned us. The real access problems that we're now facing seem to me to be in non-PC appliances, such as mobile phones, and I got a DVD, a whole home theatre system over the Christmas break. It's a nightmare. This is where we really face the crisis, isn't it?
I've always been oriented my work in assistive technology and disabilities area with employment-related issues. And I consider computer access to be one of those. I think that home entertainment systems and VCRs are an abomination. I mean, I have one, and my wife uses it and gets us started, and we get to watch a movie, but I can't operate them. I think a work-related thing is cell phones. To not have a talking cell phone is absolutely ludicrous that there isn't a talking cell phone. Maybe there is. Is there one in Australia or New Zealand?
There's a Samsung one that I recently demonstrated that talks to a fashion, and there's a Motorola product that allows you to program your own voice in a few menu options, so you can arrow through and hear menu choices in your own voice. I wouldn't call them truly accessible, but it's purely a design thing, isn't it? It's not a problem with logistics, with technological logistics.
You know that, I mean, it's limited vocabulary, and we know that you can buy a $8 US dollar 45-cent watch that talks. It's got to be that you can add voice to a cell phone for $20.
Well, many of the cell phones out these days do have voice dialing, so that you can speak the name of the party you want to call. And
but that's voice input. That's what Richard was talking
right.
about. We want voice output.
Exactly. It just what I was going to say was, it seems amazing to me that, given that you've programmed the voice in there, and that most telephones these days, most cell phones have caller ID, when you get an incoming call, it's amazing to me that if that call is coming from a phone number which has a voice dial tag attached to it. You should be able to press a button and hear that voice entry back again to confirm who's calling you.
Right. But I think you should be able to hear that independent of whether it came from a voice in phone, because you should be able to, it should synthesize speech, give you the number.
Absolutely, yeah.
Easy.
Yeah, yeah.
Easy.
Yeah. Now, I mean, given that you've got Section 255 over there of the Telecommunications Act and Section 508, why isn't it happening?
I don't know. I don't know telecom very well. That's 255. I wouldn't be surprised if 508 ended up pushing for... what do I want to say this? I want to say this right. I wouldn't be surprised if the 508 legislation led some cell phone manufacturer to market a talking telephone, talking cellular phone. Because then they could go to the government and say, we are the only company providing a talking cell phone. And they'd get all the... It's not a matter of dollars. If one company comes in and we're bidding on some product X, if one says, I got an accessible X meeting 508 standards, and the other one doesn't, the bid goes to, the contract goes to the one with the accessible X. Very strong.
Well, is the reason that that's not happening because our advocacy as blind people, both collectively and individually, is somehow being misdirected? Are we not making the right noise in the right place?
Oh dear, I don't know the answer to that question. I think that I haven't heard much advocacy that basically said that kind of reinforced 508.
All right.
I mean, I just haven't heard any. It's an interesting question. I don't know the answer.
You mentioned dreams for the future, and as we think about rounding off, I'd like to talk to you about that. Where are we going in terms of technology and equality of access to technology by blind people?
I don't know. I think that those of us who have worked and do work on assistive technology feel like it's a constant battle to catch up with the mainstream applications. I'm worried about what's happening with the web. We almost talked about it, but ended up talking about JavaScript instead. That is, things like Java and Flash and other visual plugins that convey information, and the information is totally inaccessible. And I'm afraid there's going to be more and more of that. And so we're going to have another another one of those things that, you know, that went on when the GUI first came out. Oh my goodness, we're losing it all. Just when we thought we were getting along very well. And I don't know how that's going to work out. Yes, I do know how it's going to work out. We're going to succeed, but I don't know in what way we're going to do it. I have no idea how these new technologies can be made accessible. I just don't know how to do it. And I think that's the important technology battleground as opposed to the political one.
Let's go to another phone call, which has come in from area code 661. Hello, your question for Jim Thatcher.
I really don't have a question. I have a comment.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Hi, go ahead, yeah.
Okay. My comment is that it's amazing why they can't put speech output on a cell phone when up here in the U.S., they have a pager speech output. It's been out here for a year. And I know it took a long time because pagers have been out since about 90. And I just say give it a few, I don't know, at the most a year and a half. And we'll probably see a cell phone with limited speech output, but I honestly think it will come sooner or later.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that we're going to see, and I hope it ends up being because of 508. I think we're going to see a cell phone that will talk.
And see, something I do not understand, I'm sitting here listening to the show, and the way you're saying how some sites are inaccessible, and I actually surf the internet about 13 hours out of the day, and I honestly do not understand what kind of site you're talking about when you say JavaScript and Flash, because I visit a large amount of websites that do contain these elements, and I have no problems.
Well, that's a good question. Right now, for example, my portal has always been Yahoo, and it turns out the only Flash on Yahoo is an ad. So you're certainly no worse off not knowing about that. But if that Flash technology were presenting information rather than an advertisement, you would be out that you wouldn't know about that information. When I said that, independent of Flash and Java, when I said that sites were inaccessible generally, I mean even ones without Flash and Java, I'm delighted that you're able to surf the web 13 hours a day, but I assume you don't spend much time on things like, let's say, Barnes & Noble, BN.com, or Amazon.com, unless you go to Amazon.com/access.
And I have been to Amazon.com, and I don't know whether there's an issue about this one program. I actually use America Online and do really good on that, which that was said to be a very unacceptable program for blind users.
Yeah, you probably have version 6 now?
AOL, I've been working with AOL ever since they came out back with 2.5. And I do currently have 6, and I've just been working with it, and I have not seen any problems with it.
Great.
But okay, then, I will let you get back to your show. I just wanted to put in my comments, and I guess this is something that I'm not having a problem with personally, but we'll see how it goes. But I thank you for letting me be on the show, sir.
Appreciate your call.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, yeah, one of the issues there, of course, is that we don't know what we don't know. And
that's a serious issue.
Yeah. The other thing is that there are some really competent technology users who are going to get by. And I guess I had a very similar view to that which that caller expressed until I started training others how to use the web and realizing that for some people it comes naturally, for others it's a real struggle, and I think that that no one could disagree with the fact that it's surfing the web is not as intuitive for the average blind person as it is for the average sighted person.
No, and they're fairly easy things to do to fix that. In I'd say 98% of the cases where it's difficult.
Interesting. And the web consultancy work, is that proving to keep you fairly busy? I mean, it's a bit of a growth industry, isn't it?
Yes, it's a growth industry, and I'm as busy as I want to be. I'm busier than I want to be. There are three areas of work. One is people call me up and say they want their website evaluated and they want to be told how to fix it. And I do that. I mentioned earlier that I wrote this course on web accessibility for ITAC, for the Information Technology Technical Assistance and Training Center. The web course is really not so much a course as it is a tutorial in 12 sections, and it's on my website and it's on the ITAC website, and I've gotten a lot of positive. So that was work that I did for them, and I've gotten a lot of positive feedback about that course, And then for this year for them, I'm doing an evaluation and repair tools. So I'm going, there are a number of software tools that you can buy, ranging from free to $2,500 that claim to be able to evaluate your web presence and tell you how to fix it or even fix it. And so I'm going to go in and look at these in detail and create a report for ITAC, and it'll be, again, on their site and on mine. The third thing I do is work with companies that want to in IBM, I led the effort to set up the software, web, notes, Java, hardware guidelines for accessibility on the IBM site, which is ibm.com/able, A-B-L-E. And I have worked with companies doing similar kinds of things for these internal interpretations. What is it we are committing to do that companies want to write down their plans internally about how they're going to deal with software and hardware and web, and I work with them on that. So those are the three areas. Working on websites is general content development with ITAC, and then working with companies on their own interpretation of the regulations.
Well, it's been fascinating having a chat to you over the last hour. I appreciate you giving up some time on your Sunday evening. And I hope as this whole 5-hour wait thing beds down and there are further developments that we may speak again sometime.
Thank you very much, John.
Thank you. Bye-bye now. That's Jim Thatcher, who's been joining us, and a very fascinating chat with him about a whole range of things that he's been involved with. Let me just try. See, you go away for a month and look what happens. We'll try that again.
Programming on ACB Radio is made possible in part through financial support from the Verizon Corporation. Verizon, a proud supporter of ACB Radio.
And we're in the open forum part of the program now. If you'd like to give us a call and have a chat about anything, anything that's on your mind, you may have been saving it up, thinking, you know, I really must talk about this on Blind Line. I'm sure you've been thinking that all the time. Yeah. Then you can give us a call. The number, courtesy of spiderphone.com, and you should be able to find it in your title bar, is 212-812-2800. That's an American number, 212-812-2800. And when you're asked to enter a PIN or a conference code, you can enter 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512, and we will chat about whatever you want to chat about. And I've certainly got a few ideas that I'll throw into the melting pot as well. Let's talk about, I'll tell you what, I had a great break. I'll tell you that first. Yep, wonderful time. Going to take me a while to get up to speed. The weather's been a bit funny. I don't know, sometimes I wonder about this global warming. It might be happening. Bit of rain, perfectly fine now that we're all going back to work here in New Zealand, of course. The cricket has been tremendous. We are doing well at the cricket. We beat Australia twice. We've beaten South Africa. It's a truly marvellous world. The cricket is good. Lots of fun things happening over Christmas. New Year's resolutions. If you want to talk about something a bit lighter today, did you make a New Year's resolution? Have you kept to it? I made a New Year's resolution. And I'm pleased to tell you I've kept it so far. What are we at? 21st here in New Zealand. 21 days. For 21 days I have been a vegetarian. It really hit me when I was on the farm in Whangamomona when they went out and killed this lamb that turned up as lamb chops the next morning. I thought, I just can't do this anymore. So on the 1st of January I said I'm not eating meat anymore, and I haven't. And actually, surprisingly enough, for most of the time, I haven't missed it. So there you go. I am now Jonathan Mosen, the non-eat-eating man. And let's go to the phones and say hello to area code 559. How are you doing?
Hi, how are you doing? How's it going?
Oh, not too bad for a blind man, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah. Obviously it's Dave here. I'm talking on my cell phone because I get all kinds of free minutes, so.
Oh, you are a man of influence.
Yes, I'm trying to... I'm actually trying to imitate CT. Oh, I shouldn't say that, should I?
No, you shouldn't.
No, but I did. Interesting what you just brought up about your feelings on being a vegetarian. And
yep.
I remember you distinctly in previous time stating your feeling that, you know, it was not a moral thing to do, to eat meat and whatever. And the subject kind of came up this morning. I listened to a program. I'm kind of an agnostic. I don't know how I feel about the whole religious thing. But I listened to a program on the Sunday morning called God Talk. Actually, you can get it over there. It's on KGO Radio. You can get it on the Internet. And
yes.
One of the things he said, he read an article by, I believe it was Dershowitz, somebody Dershowitz. And the article basically was prefaced by saying, the only people who can actually claim to be moral are atheists. And his reason for saying this was that the theist will be looking for either a reward or at least the lack of punishment, whereas an atheist is that it's the moral thing to do whatever to behave in whatever way they're going to. I thought it was an interesting supposition.
Goodness me, that's very heavy stuff. So does that mean that it's okay for people who are not atheists to do heaps of bad things?
I don't know. That would certainly get. I mean, no, it's not okay because obviously they're not going to reap their rewards if they do. So, all he's saying is that there's a reason for them to not do bad things. The reason is because they'll get zapped if they do.
But this is one of the things that's always fascinated me from the time since I stopped being a Christian, is that you can go around doing all these mean and nasty things and then go to church on Monday morning and get Sunday morning and get the slate wiped clean.
Yeah, I don't know. There's got to be some more to this than meets call for that. That came up with your discussion. I was more interested as listening to you calling, asking Mr. Thayer what he thought was in the future, and he basically said he didn't know. One of the things I think we have to look at is that we've run into, everybody up until now has been, I think we've all been absolutely focused on the issue of employment, and that's fine, and we're still not there, of course, as far as employment, but I think now we need to start looking at other things that make up a quality of life. Employment
sure.
is not the be-all and end-all that's going to make up one's quality of life.
Mm.
And these other issues of, can we use the cell phone? Can we use our electric ranges, for crying out loud? Or our home theaters? All of these issues are a quality of life, and I think we have to stop and say, you know, have we been sacrificing our quality of life stuff for employment, and it's time to quit that if we are. I think we need to really to back up. You also asked about why you thought, the fact we do have Section 508 and the other code, and I think the reason that these have not had any effect is because basically all a company has to do is say, well, that's not a reasonable expectation for us to put voice in our cell phones, and that's it. It's done. It's not reasonable. Fine.
Well, I think that all of the technology experts, we had Jim Fruchterman commenting on this, believe it or not, we were supposed to be talking to him about Bookshare, which we did, but then we got onto this whole accessibility thing on Main Menu, and he was making exactly the same kind of comment that Jim Thatcher has just made, that it's a few bucks to put in a pretty simple voice synthesis chip that will give you reasonable access to your cell phone, and really, there is no excuse, and it does make me wonder why it isn't happening.
It's not happening because the market isn't there. It's all market-driven. And we are, whether we want to be or not, we're not the market. We're only a part of the market.
Sure. But wasn't Jim Thatcher's point, though, that we're now altering that market through the 508 intervention, and that if you have a cell phone manufacturer that comes along and says, hey, I've got a 508 compliant cell phone here, then they're going to get the contract against a non-508 compliant cell phone. Surely that should be influential enough.
Perhaps, but somebody has to come along and make that step first, and I don't think we've seen that yet.
No, we haven't. We certainly haven't, but it just seems absolutely curious to me that for a few bucks, a cell phone manufacturer could be guaranteed of a whole lot of extra government procurement, and they're not doing it. Amazing.
Well, the government procured, the government per, when looked at the market as a whole, is probably still not a very high market share, and they're just not going to do it because it's a few bucks times, you know, how many thousand or how many hundred thousand. And a company, you know, the society in which we live, and I think it's, you know, whether it's, you know, we're especially over here, it's strictly market driven, and if the public wants it, well, you know, it'll happen. If the public doesn't want it, it won't. I think back to a time in the late 70s, early 80s, when some of the car manufacturers, and I saw this in a Dodge in particular, had some speaking meters on it, like, you know, your seat belts aren't on and your gas tank is getting low. People hated it. They absolutely hated it.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, so I don't know. The sighted public is just not interested in that sort of thing, and I don't know why. I don't know what we can do to alter the mindset.
Someone I went to school with was just like that. She was blind, but she used to sit in the car and say, "Slow down!" to the person who was driving. It would be just like having a, you know, nagging backseat driver, but a robotic one. That'd be such a drag.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's just not. I you know what the answer is. I don't know. But don't get me started on that. And then
I'm not going to get you started on. I just want to express my gratitude that you have given up some of your free minutes to speak to ACB Radio.
Oh, I'm glad to give up my free minutes for such exciting and august company. Take care, Jonathan. Have a good one.
Thanks very much. See you later. ACB Radio Mainstream and Blind Line with Uncle Jonathan on a Monday afternoon here. Area code, it's 21 degrees outside. It's lovely. Area code 717. Hello there. Hello, area code 717. Oh, well, I don't know. Let me just see what I'm doing here. Oh, well, perhaps if I push the right button. You see, never give Jonathan a break because he doesn't know what he's doing. I think you can talk now.
I had a question. I had to change the subject a little bit.
That's
all
right.
I'm going to be a college student next year.
That's fine. Go for it.
Yeah. I was wondering, I have a braille note now that I plan to be using as a braille display in college, and I was wondering what you and other people felt about the difference or whether I should invest in a desktop computer or a laptop computer.
So you haven't got either at the moment, is that right?
Well, I have a desktop here at home, but I probably won't be taking it to college because it is my family's computer, unfortunately.
And it's and it's a Braille note that you have at the moment?
Yeah, and that is mine. I will be taking that with me. I just got it for Christmas.
That should be fine for taking your lecture notes and reading documents and things. The one thing that immediately comes to mind is, of course, at the moment you won't be able to surf the web with it. And I think it could be said there is a legitimate, you know, a legitimate use of research time to go doing the web. So you're going to get a PC. You're just not sure whether it's a laptop or a desktop.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, I mean, I think if you've got the problem for you pay a premium for the portability. You know, it's going to cost you extra to get a good laptop.
Yeah.
That gives comparable specs with the desktop. But if you've got it, I'd definitely go for the laptop. Definitely. Yeah,
that's what I was thinking, because then I would have web access when I needed it. Portability, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think anything will really beat anything like a note taker, whether it be a Braille Note or a Braille Lite for lectures, because their batteries just go on and on. One thing I've found, I recently got a ThinkPad, and I found that you can go in and turn the screen off, and by doing that, I've actually had considerably longer battery life out of the laptop.
Wow. That's interesting, because I do that all the time. I'm in a computer science class at school when I'm going to go into programming, and it's like the teacher comes over and I ask her a question, and she's like, "Oh, the screen's turned off." I'm like, "Whoops."
Well, also it's good because you can be in a meeting or in a class or whatever, and playing accessible. What do they call that thing? Accessible Starfight. I've got one of those wireless modems, you know, so you can sit in a meeting and you can play. Not that I do this, I should say I don't do this, but you could be playing Accessible Starfight over a wireless internet connection on your laptop and the screen's turned off. And no one would know. Yeah.
Wow, wouldn't that? Yeah, that would be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I tell you, the fact that the screen's turned off really bothers some teachers. I'm not sure why.
Because they can't keep tabs on you. But you see, I don't like the idea of someone peering over my shoulder, and even when I am doing legitimate things, which I always am on the PC, I don't like the idea that they're sort of peering and leering and knowing what's on my screen. So I like it turned off.
Well, I'd like to also make a comment on web accessibility. I kind of agree with the caller that said that he really didn't know what the problems were with web accessibility. I guess, you know, I do a lot of web surfing, too, and I guess you're right that I'm sort of one of these people that's going to get by either way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this is the dilemma that I find myself in. I mean, you've got to see it to believe it. There are some blind people who really, really struggle.
Yeah.
And, I mean, people who are familiar with it or who just take to it naturally, they see a link on a website that doesn't have alt text, and they sit there and they can sometimes derive what the link's going to point to based on all the something relevant at the end of all the gobbledygook that's there. For some people, they just don't know how to do that, you know?
Well, yeah. And I think what helps a lot with that is Braille, believe it or not, because if you don't have the seeing of the actual word, it can be really difficult. If you see the words, a lot of times I've found now that I'm using a Braille display, I can figure out, because I have a Braille Note 32, which is a pretty decent Braille display.
It's good, isn't it? Yeah.
I can figure out what the word is.
Yeah.
But I couldn't do that before.
No, it's excellent. Well, I hope that you get some comment on this desktop versus laptop issue and the pros and the cons. You know, laptops come in a huge range of categories. They have one called a category called desktop replacement, and they tend to be quite bulky. But then you get, like the ThinkPad that I have, it's tiny, it's light, it's only about 1.5 kilos, which I think is about under 3 pounds. And it's got no floppy drive, hardly any ports, and if you want all those things, you just put it into this little docking station type device. It's not called a docking station, it's called, I forget, but it's quite nifty. And then once you dock it in there, you've got the parallel ports and serial and different things. So that's the best of both worlds.
You know, I think the only thing I would need really is a serial port to hook the Braille Note up to for ActiveSync and for a Braille display.
Yeah, and what I did to get around that problem was, because the ThinkPad has two USB ports, I bought a little USB to serial converter.
Oh, okay.
And that does the job. Yeah.
And just use that.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I hope you get some feedback on that. I appreciate you giving us a call.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
It's a pleasure. Bye now. We'll go back to the board in just a moment, but there is something I did want to raise, and we're already at 19 minutes past the hour, so let me do that. This business with the Supreme Court in the United States just recently having come down with a decision that some people are saying reigns in the scope of the Americans with Disabilities Act. In fact, I guess there's no doubt that it does that. The question is whether you think it's a good thing or not. Be interested in your views on this. In case you're not fully up with the play, in the case that was before the Supreme Court, Ella Williams was the woman's name. She sought coverage under the ADA because she suffered from carpal tunnel syndrome. That's a painful impairment of muscles and tendons causing... it's caused, in fact, in her case, by repetitive movement. She worked on an assembly line for Toyota in Georgetown, Kentucky, and she was fired after she was no longer able to do the job assigned to her. Now, Williams sued under the ADA. She said that the company should have accommodated her disability and reassigned her to a job where she didn't have to work, polishing cars with her arms outstretched. So the court considered this, and in a unanimous opinion that was written by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, the court said that Williams' injuries didn't rise to the level of a disability. So what they're ruling is that carpal tunnel syndrome, when it is considered against your ability to do a particular job, doesn't qualify under the ADA. She was still able to perform many daily tasks with her hands and arms, including brushing her teeth, gardening, and cooking. That's what the court said. Her problems with certain types of manual tasks were not sufficiently onerous, according to the court, to constitute a limit to the major life activity that triggers the ADA. So what do you think of this? I don't know whether my view is way out in left field or particularly a minority one, but I say, great. and that's not in any way to undermine or understate the impact that carpal tunnel syndrome has on people, but is it a disability? See, there's been a trend over the last few years, prevalent pretty much everywhere in the Western world. Well, I think there's been a deliberate strategy among disability advocates to try and widen the net of disability, perhaps because of the very things that we've been discussing today, that if only we could convince people that we were a larger market, we'd be taken more notice of. And so then you get all these statistics that came out saying things like, well, 1 in 5 of us have a disability, and this is what's happening. Now you get all sorts of interesting people trying to invoke disability legislation around the world, such as the ADA. And what the Supreme Court has said is, no, you've got to have a significant disability, that was what the legislators intended when they passed the ADA. It seems to me there's by no means a unanimous negative reaction to this. I've seen press releases from disability groups saying this is a terrible thing, and a few people standing up and saying, no, it's not, because now at last, maybe those people who have significant disabilities, and not medical conditions, but disabilities, will be taken more seriously. Be interested in your thoughts on that. And we are talking to you on Blind Line. If you'd like to give us a call, it's area code 212-812-2800 and the PIN 04805512. And we go to area code 631. Hello there.
Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
Good, Richard. How's it going, man?
Yeah, good, good. Very good.
Excellent.
As you were talking, I was thinking about it because I agree with your preference as far as saying, yeah, that's great as far as, because in a sense it's kind of a gray area. It isn't a disability, but it is, because because I know my mother, she has problem with her hands, and fortunately it's not very serious, but I could see where if
carpal tunnel syndrome.
Yeah.
Definitely not carnal.
Yeah, I could see it to where it could be to the point to where the person couldn't be able to do anything. So I think in her case, they were right, because I don't think the disability, her condition was serious enough. But I'm sure there are people that have much more debilitating conditions of that condition. So I think it depends on how affected the person was, and obviously I don't think she was affected great enough to where she couldn't do other things. And I think that's where Jay O'Connor was making the distinction. She was saying that it didn't cross the line in the criteria for ADA, and that's why I think the decision wasn't a bad decision.
No, see, here's something that I think that some of the people who are objecting to the decision appear to be missing. They're saying that the Supreme Court decision in some way seeks to invalidate the ADA in terms of saying that working is not a major life activity, but I don't think that they have necessarily said that. What they've said is that she clearly couldn't perform this particular job, but it doesn't mean that she couldn't actually work at all.
And from what the impression I was getting is that she was saying this, that she wasn't unwilling to work. She was just saying, give me a task to where I don't have to put pressure on this injury, because I think she was more than willing to work for the company. It's just that she said, give me a job that I can do that won't aggravate my condition, which to me seemed perfectly fair and reasonable.
Yes, and I think that there are workers' compensation laws that could have been activated, but I understand there were some sort of legal issues with the way that was filed.
Probably.
Mm. Yeah, got to do it right. That's the problem with the law, you know.
Yeah. But one other thing, Jonathan, you know, as far as when you were talking with the guest tonight about the Yeah, the other problem, as you say, you know, even the basic thing like with JAWS for Windows now, and I understand a lot of the XP users, if they're trying to use a DVD, the basic, the way they have to do, the way the JAWS virtual device driver works, they have to completely remove JAWS in order to use their DVD player, which is, to me, you know, ridiculous. And yet JAWS has known about this problem with NT in 2000, the last year or so, and yet they still haven't fixed the problem?
Yeah, I have heard that. I don't have any personal experience of it yet because I don't have a DVD player and a PC to check it on, but I certainly have heard that. I suppose that we can get quite lyrical and upset about the bugs that different screen reader manufacturers choose not to fix.
Right.
I mean, you know, what's a priority for us just seems not to rank, and I guess they got to get a product out the door somehow. But that does seem like a weird one.
Yeah, and it seems like, you know, why should something that is supposedly, I guess, you know, we're blind, we don't have, it shouldn't affect the device driver of something that's visual, and yet it totally screws up the DVD players, and I mean that is just like totally bizarre, and yet they've known about this problem for over a year.
The only thing I can think of is that JFW, it does have a tendency to be quite video card dependent, and it may have something to do with what's going on with the video when you're playing DVDs.
Yeah. And I think also there's still the same problem that JAWS has, and supposedly that it's supposed to fix now as far as the color depth. Because I think up until this point, I think you really were stuck with although you could use 16-bit, I think, and I have my laptop and my PC set at 16-bit, and it doesn't seem to have any problem with 3.7 and 4.0, but supposedly that's one of the other reasons to go to 4.1, is that it's supposed to finally fix this problem of color depth, and it sounds like that it hasn't quite done it.
Well, I think the issue there may well be the whole question of labeling of graphics, and because Windows XP is using, I think, 16-bit as its default color depth, whereas previous versions used 256 as its default color depth, they've had to get real and label the graphics in those higher resolutions, as has WindowEyes, I believe, and it's WindowEyes Professional Beta as well.
Way before even XP was developed, they were doing it in prior versions way before XP.
I can't remember about that, because I think if you read the README file, they made some sort of comment about how this is the default now. Maybe they've just stopped supporting their lower resolution graphics.
I don't think they found the right case as far as the Supreme Court goes, as far as the real test of ADA and job access. I think the only other one that maybe came close, which never came to trial, was the one that NFB was using against AOL to make their software, which I still don't think they've made their software accessible anyway.
Well, you see, now this comes back to that age-old argument that we've talked about so often: what constitutes accessibility? Because you had a guy on when we had Jim Thatcher on who said, "I've been using AOL since 2.5 and it works just fine."
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the problem. I mean, if we could find a piece of software where everybody could agree this thing absolutely sucks, it's totally unusable, that'd be a good thing to take under ADA.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and like I say, the other thing that I find astounding is, which in a way is also kind of sad, is why there really isn't anything good developed screen reader for Apple, and yet you don't have anybody taking Apple to court as to making their PCs and their hardware and all accessible. You don't hear anything about that at all. The only thing you ever hear is Microsoft anyway.
Oh man, now we've taken a break for what, 4 weeks, and now you've become all sympathetic to Microsoft.
No, I haven't become sympathetic to Microsoft at all. I'm just saying is that it just seems odd that we've yelled at Microsoft and done nothing in terms of Apple.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I think it's unfair. But I was just, you know, observing.
Buzzing my horns, I know.
Yes, yes.
Giving me a hard time since you're so sunny and refreshed, and you're not. You don't even have your batteries discharged yet. You're just raring to go.
I am. It's all these fresh veggies.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, have a good evening, and don't forget to call in tomorrow and listen to the Snowman's new show with Mike Bullis.
I heard that promo. That sounds like a very interesting... Was that Mike... which Mike was it? I couldn't quite place the voice.
Mike Bullis. B-U-L-I-S.
Oh, okay.
I think they're going to call the... I think they're going to call the show Snowball, by the way.
That sounds like James.
Yeah.
Alrighty, sir.
Have a good night.
You too.
Okay, bye now. This is ACB Radio Mainstream, and let's say hello to Joe Norton.
And good afternoon, Jonathan.
Good afternoon to you.
And just noticed from your MSN Messenger thing that you're using Windows XP, at least in some cases.
I've got it on the laptop, yeah.
Just curious, how have you found it
personally? I love it. I love it. It's the most worthwhile upgrade I've done since 95, since 3.1 to 95. In particular, the fact that, you know, the task manager with Control-Alt-Delete works so well.
Oh, yeah, that thing works like a top.
Oh, man.
I mean, I have to say that much, you know. Yeah. You've never had that kind of access to it.
Yeah.
Before.
I sort of wish that I hadn't done the conversion to NTFS, though. Because I think things are running a bit slower since I did that.
Yeah, I need to get more resources going on my machine before I really totally use it, you know, totally go over to XP. But I'm a glutton for punishment, so I like to experiment with anything that's out there. Been playing with the Window Eyes beta and such things like that. And dug out my old serial synthesizer so I could use it under Window Eyes because I just hated using Eloquence. I mean, I don't have a problem with the voice of Eloquence. But I do want more of my resources free to do other things with or whatever, and I just feel much better with a hardware synthesizer. It seems like my response is just a little bit better and everything with that.
So. Well, we've been talking about this on the Braille Note List because there are lots of synthesizers that aren't supported under JAWS and the XP and NT platforms, including...
And JAWS and WindowEyes. The list is considerably smaller on both of them, I guess.
Is that right? I thought WindowEyes was pretty complete. There are certainly more under WindowEyes. For example, the Keynote works under WindowEyes, and it won't work under JAWS in XP.
Yeah, it is just a little smaller, I guess.
Okay.
I guess it's not quite as bad as JAWS. I haven't really... To be quite honest, I haven't compared them, so don't give me any flames, or hope I don't get too many flames on that one.
Oh, me too. That's my New Year's resolution. No flames for me this year, please.
But interesting about the ADA issue, I don't think I'd heard that case, actually, or heard of it in the news, but and you and Richard need to be careful with your bloopers. This is a family show here.
I couldn't believe that.
Anyway, but no, just kidding here, but anyway, I guess that is kind of an odd issue to take up with the ADA. I hadn't thought about even trying to make the ADA apply to that one, but in this town, Dalton, Georgia, is a carpet town. That's basically probably 98% of everything here, other than the service industry, has to do with carpet, and the service industry backs it up. But there are probably people here suffering from CTS, and I would say other possible conditions because of repetitive jobs. And, you know, some people talk about getting on light duty or whatever, but I'm a bit doubtful as to whether there's any light duty in this town, or at least a whole lot, because most of the unskilled labor is going to be manual, and there are probably very few light duty jobs out there in the mill, you know, unless you get on driving a lift truck or something like that, and I don't even know how light that is. I've never tried it. I've been trying to get them to let me drive a lift truck, but so far it hasn't happened yet.
No, I'm pleased to hear that. Enough lunatics on the road.
They probably do as good as some of the ones they have, but
anyway. Yeah. But, you know, I think what's happened over the last 12 years or so, nearly, that the ADA's been in place, is that there's been a gradual stretching of the law, you know, and that more and more what I would consider to be medical conditions are being, or at least there's been an attempt to classify them as a disability.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And two, this the thing with NFB picking on AOL. I guess I have noticed a little bit of an improvement in AOL accessibility. This person that you were talking to earlier that said they were using AOL back to 2.5, I think,
yes,
he said. Did we ever clarify? I don't remember hearing him say whether he was totally blind or not.
No, he didn't say.
Yeah, so I don't know if he had some vision as to whether that might aid him in using AOL. What about Prodigy? You hear anything about blind people on Prodigy?
I didn't even know that Prodigy was still going. Is it still out there?
Maybe not. It seems like I heard of some addresses for Prodigy maybe a year or two ago, but maybe it's gone now. You do know that back in the DOS days, there was one of the screen reader vendors actually did work with the Prodigy people to make their product work with his screen reader.
That was ISOS, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Ned Johnson, I think his name was.
Yeah, there was an article in NewsBits. Do you remember NewsBits?
Oh, I do. Fine publication. I used to drop everything when my NewsBits arrived.
Oh, yeah. I paid. You know, the sad part is I paid for a year's subscription and 6 months later, he discontinued it.
Oh, dear.
Well, you know, I did get compensated. He said, you know, you can get a credit or you can get something off toward this other series that I'm offering. I didn't have a PC yet, so I said, well, I'm going to call him up. So I called up Doug Wakefield, and I said, hey, you know, I don't really need either one of these things, but, you know, I paid for a year's subscription. And I wonder if you'd be willing, because I know they sold back issues at the time. I said, I wonder if you'd be willing to send me the back issues for the beginning of the year up to where I was, so at least I'd have a year's subscription. You know, give me the option. You know, otherwise I'll take the credit. And he was quite willing to do that, so I got the full year out of it. In fact, I've got the DOS 5 one where he talked about DOS 5, I think was when I started Office. Sometimes interesting just to go back and listen to that and think how far we've come.
Yes, it is, and that's a great, good production values in NewsBits. Very well produced. Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind hearing some more of them. It'd be nice to still be able to get them, but I think his business is gone. In fact, what is Doug doing? Do you know? Any idea?
No, I don't. We should get him on the program. He's someone we've never asked to be on Blind Line, and that would be a hoot if we could get Doug on here.
Yeah, he said, you know, at the end of his NewsBits, the last one, he said he'd taken a job with the federal government in broadcasting, and I never was clear on exactly what that was.
Well, he's done some work with the Access Board since then. But I've got a very patient person waiting to talk to us, so I shouldn't keep them waiting too long, you know.
Oh, yep. Well, anyway, be careful with those help balloons and XP. So.
Pure. Yeah, man, I will. And take my advice and download the, in fact, take Jeff Bishop's advice and put me onto this. Download the Windows XP Power Toys and get rid of that dreadful find dialogue that's in there and replace it with an old star one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I haven't tried that.
It's in the tweak UI in the Windows XP Power Toys.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, take care.
You too, man.
Okay, goodbye.
Catch you later. Bye. Gee, it's scary. I sound like the snowman imitating me. Area code 408, hello there.
Hi, this is Mary Emerson from California. I called you back in November, right after I got my DSL up and running.
Hi, Mary, I remember you. How are you going with your computer?
Oh, it's working quite well.
Excellent.
I'm quite happy with it. Called about a couple things. One thing was I wanted to give you a bunch of encouragement about being a vegetarian.
Oh, good. Are you one?
I am one. I have been for over 20 years.
Now, I'll tell you, here's something you'll be able to answer for me, I'm sure, because as soon as I mention to friends and family that I'm a vegetarian, the instant reaction from almost all of them is that you have to eat meat for all of the iron, and you're going to go anemic if you're a vegetarian.
I haven't heard that.
Oh, God.
Because I take quite a few supplements.
Right.
You know, various vitamin mineral supplements that have just about all the minerals that you would ever need. One thing that you probably should supplement is your B12, because plants, for the most part, don't have B12 in them, and you really need that in your daily diet.
What does it do?
It's just a vitamin B12. It helps to make all the other B vitamins work.
Okay. All right.
So that's something, you know, probably a good basic vitamin and mineral supplement would be a real good idea. But I've been really happy as a vegetarian. As a matter of fact, living alone, I tend to use a lot of the frozen veggies because the fresh ones just, you know, if you buy them, they go bad. It's so quick that you don't have time to eat them.
And yeah.
It's much easier that way. But one thing that also you might be interested in, there are different degrees of vegetarianism. There is the vegan, actually, which is the pure vegetarian, no eggs, no dairy. And then you have the ovo-lacto, which is basically what I am, which means that you do eat eggs and dairy products, and those dairy products can be real fattening.
Oh, yes, lovely.
I eat a lot of cheese.
Yeah, I don't know what the moral justification is for pure veganism. I understand that you wouldn't want to eat eggs that aren't free-range, you know, and things, but it seems to me, you know, what harm are you doing eating eggs and cheese, really? You know?
Well, I suppose probably most of it is due to just the fact they don't want to have any animal products.
Hmm.
You know, I think a lot of it also depends on your background, such as the Hindus and some of the others who really feel that life is sacred.
Sure.
And because of that you really need to let life live as best it can. But then you draw the line, you say, well, you have to eat something.
but also, I mean, by eating eggs and having cheese and dairy products, you're not killing anything, though. That's right. I mean, I became a vegetarian for those moral reasons. But it's something, you know, something. There's an amazing amount of, I don't know if you've had a look at this since you've been on the net and everything, but there's an amazing amount of vegetarian resource out there.
Yeah, I've been to one or two sites where they even told you how to become a vegetarian activist and encourage people not to eat meat.
Yes.
Which is kind of interesting.
There's a very popular article that I've seen on a gazillion websites called How to Win an Argument with a Meat Eater. But you know, it's a bit like being a reformed smoker, I think, or a fitness fanatic. You know, when you take something like this up, you're absolutely convinced and you become a bit evangelical about it. So I'm trying to avoid doing that on the radio.
Right.
Mm.
Right.
So what else did you have for me?
The other comment was that I was very interested in Thatcher's comments. I do work for IBM, but I've noticed with a lot of large companies that from the employee point of view, it's a little bit frightening when management kind of sends down the word that you are going to use this particular tool and you find out the tool is not accessible and you're kind of sitting there going, well, I'm just a peon. What do I do about this?
Yeah. So has that happened to you at IBM?
It has. It has. Mm. And I think there's a trend in the workforce, just in, I'm trying to keep this as general as I can because I don't want to pick on any one company at all.
Understood, especially your employer.
Right.
Yes.
but there's a trend in the workforce that I've seen that there is a lot of this going on where they hand out this bunch of stuff that you're supposed to use, and of course anybody who is disabled has to scramble to try to not only keep their job but use what everybody else is using, and it's from the employee point of view, it's a very frightening thing to have to deal with every day. And I think that has contributed to one of the reasons why there just aren't as many employed disabled people as there once were. That's just one point of view.
I'm thinking about that, and I think you're right, that you have devices, for example, like the Braille Note, that will create Microsoft Word documents. But unless you can really go into an office and say, I'm proficient in Microsoft Word, you know, it's hard to get people interested. Even then, it's hard to get people interested.
Right.
Yeah. Mm. Interesting. Well, it's very nice to hear from you again, and I shall keep you posted on how my non-meat eating is getting on.
Yeah, you're going to run into a couple of challenges like luncheons and restaurants and things.
I did, actually. I went out to dinner last week with an old friend of mine who we've been friends for, I don't know, 20 years or something ridiculous. And No, nearly 30 years. Goodness. Yeah. And we sat down to dinner, and they had the most delicious-sounding steak on the menu. But I didn't... I felt very good about not succumbing, actually.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Well, yes, thank you. Yeah, it all helps. Well, we'll talk again, I'm sure, and have a wonderful new year.
Oh, you too.
Thanks. Okay, right. Bye-bye now. We've still got a bit of time for calls. If you'd like to get in touch with us, it's area code 212-812-2800. It's area code 212-812-2800, and then when you're asked to enter a conference code, it's 04805512. You should be able to find that information in your title bar. The conference code again, 04805512, and we'd be absolutely delighted to hear from you. Here's an interesting story. It comes from the Press Association. See what you think of this. Two guide dogs who led their owners to safety minutes before the collapse of the World Trade Center have been honoured by the British Guide Dogs for the Blind Association. Michael Hinkson and Omar Rivera were led down the crowded stairs of the burning towers by their dogs. The dogs, both yellow Labradors, found their way through the buildings and took their owners through debris-filled streets in time to escape safely from the terrorist attacks. The dogs were honoured by the association at an international conference in Texas and presented with specially made trophies. I'm sure they'd rather have had a big bag of dog biscuits, but in any case, I digress. The association's chief executive, Geraldine Peacock, said guide dogs are trained to look after their owners' needs and guide them through difficult situations. But this was clearly unprecedented, and both dogs handled themselves with tremendous courage and devotion. We're extremely proud of them and are honoured to commend them for their outstanding acts of courage. The exemplary behaviour of these dogs in circumstances that could never be anticipated during their training is a credit to the professional staff and organisations that prepare guide dogs with such thorough and high standards of training. Mr. Hinkson and Rosalie also led another woman who had been blinded by debris in her eyes to safety after the collapse of the second tower, meaning the yellow Labrador rescued two people on the day of the kamikaze strikes. We got down, here's a bit of common sense, we got down the same way as everyone else did, said Mr. Hinkson, 51, who walked down the stairways in the flaming towers with colleague David Frank. The smell of jet fuel in the stairwell was distinct and often overwhelming. We ran into groups of frightened people who had stopped their descent in fear. David, Rosalie and I would stop and give them a hug, an encouragement that we were all in this together, and try and get them moving again. Monsieur Rivera and Dog Salty made their own way safely from the 71st floor down the same smoke-filled and debris-strewn staircases. The 43-year-old systems designer told the New York Times he was very nervous, but he didn't run away. The two took more than an hour and a quarter to escape, and within minutes of getting out of the building, the tower collapsed. Mr. Rivera said because he could not see, he was able to avoid paying attention to the destruction as he made his way down the stairs. Not being able to see also allowed me to concentrate on asking God to please allow me to go back and hug my family, he said. So that's the story from the Press Association. Interesting story, that, isn't it? Because it focuses on the dogs, and it must be a dreadful experience for any kind of animal to be in that situation, whether you're a trained service animal or not. But I see that they didn't really give an award to David. Was his name David Frank, the guy who led, who also helped to lead Michael Hinkson out of the building? And that the comments from the director of the guide dog school, who has come up with this honour, essentially, I don't think, gave full recognition to the teamwork that goes on in a guide dog team. this seems to me to have perhaps been rather cynically used as a publicity-raising exercise for guide dogs. Especially when you get a guide dog school handing out for this kind of trophy, I guess they hope that people will think it's marvellous and donate more. Now, that may be incredibly cynical of me, but I really just think that perhaps a little bit more credit could have been paid to the blind individuals who also kept their call under considerable pressure and who obviously nurtured that very special bond between a guide dog and a blind person. In a guide dog team, it does take two. We still have 5 minutes to go on Blind Line. If you'd like to give us a call, area code 212-812-2800 is the number. Area code 212-812-2800. You may have a comment on that story. The PIN, if you wish to enter it, is 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. We will look forward to your call. Otherwise, I will go. Not long to go, but I'm sure we can fit a call or two in if you wish to express an opinion on anything that we've talked about today, or perhaps even at this very late stage, raising something completely different, as Monty Python would say. I'll tell you something else I did over the summer holidays while we wait for an influx of calls at the last minute here. I shaved off my moustache. Yes! Yeah. And when I went to the breakfast table, Heidi, my five-year-old, was giggling away. And my three-year-old Richard made the very insightful comment, "That means that Daddy isn't blind anymore." Go figure. I bet you that this is Michael Killian calling me from Nashville.
Good evening, Jonathan.
I recognize...
It's afternoon for me, it's evening.
I recognize that face anywhere.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah.
Just wanted to let you know I've got a... I haven't put it together yet, but I've got an idea for an interesting review coming up.
Oh, good.
Figuring next... So, 2 or 3 weeks.
Yeah.
It's for an unusual website that allows you to send delayed emails.
What emails?
Delayed.
I see. Now, what would be a practical application for that?
Oh. The example the site uses is a woman who has to give her boss information or an indication by email when she's leaving for the day. And she set it up so that he receives the email at the proper time, but she takes off an hour early.
Oh, man, how wicked. It's wicked.
Hey. I'm going to look at the site and see how accessible it is.
You can do that, certainly, I don't know about Outlook Express, but you can certainly do it in Microsoft Outlook. Did you know that? You can actually set a time that your email is going to get sent off.
No, I did not know that. I only have Outlook Express.
Yeah. But, I mean, not to take anything away from a website that will do it. Well, that sounds very fascinating.
I came across this early this year, in other words, about 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Learned about it from one of these e-zines that I've gotten over the last few months.
Excellent.
It's definitely interesting.
Well, I'll look forward to you putting that together because, you know, it's a new year and we're looking for new contributions for Main Menu, so that sounds good.
Yeah, the way this will be set up is I will have to specify to you exactly when it should be run because of the way I'm setting it up. It'll have to be run on a specific date. I'll try and send it to you at least 2 weeks ahead of time.
Okay. All right. That sounds intriguing. Hey, now, having had you rescue me, I've got one more call before I have to get out of here, so I'll quickly take that and be on my way, I'm afraid.
Sounds like a winner, then.
Have a good evening.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. Last call for the evening, and we say hello to area code 305.
Hi, Jonathan. This is Lynn.
Hello, Lynn. How are you?
Great. It's been a long time. I'm so glad to hear your voice again.
And yours.
Again.
Yeah.
I just have a quick comment, and I'm wondering, I'm interested to see what your definition of disability is. Because I think part of the problem here, and I agree with the court's decision as well, but I wonder if we could get sort of a definition of disability that would make sense to everybody.
Whoever does that, yeah, needs
a
medal.
Sort of like, it seems to me that the word disability is almost like accessibility. What is accessible?
Yes.
How do we define what is accessible? And
I suppose that the definition of disability in the ADA makes the point that, you know, it limits the performing of major... I'm just looking for the definition here because I had it written down. And I can't find it just quickly enough. But major life functions, I think, is the kind of terminology that they're using. And
right, because some of us as blind folks are independent enough that
sure.
Would we really be considered disabled? Would we qualify? I mean, we're going through that right now with paratransit in our area. A lot of people will say, well, blind people shouldn't be using paratransit because they can walk.
Yes.
Basically. And the reason I use it is because I have a very dangerous street near my house across to get to the bus stop. So, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, you guys don't qualify because you can walk, basically.
This is a subject that maybe people will give some thought to for the next week and come back on, because what you've prompted in my mind is this question. If you subscribe to a philosophy that says that with the proper training and opportunity, the average blind person can perform the average function with an average degree of success, then does the ADA actually apply to blind people under that philosophy if the definition of disability involves a limitation of a substantial life function?
Right, that's exactly the point I was trying to make.
That's a really good question.
You know, I think you're right. It's probably a question for another show. But I just wanted to ask one more quick question.
Sure.
That's totally unrelated, and I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay.
I want to know what you think of the new Napster. Is it going to... I think it's a total... It's ridiculous.
You'll have to tell me, what is it like? Because I haven't seen it yet.
Well, basically, you can download... I mean, it's a subscription service,
yeah.
Obviously, which isn't bad in itself, but everything is in this NAP format.
Oh, really? So it's a proprietary format.
Yeah, which, you know, you can't copy, you can't listen to it on anything except for this NAP player that you have to use. I mean, it's so awful that it's just beyond, I mean, it's a lost cause.
Well, my sympathy for the recording industry has gone down a million notches since some of them have started copy protecting CDs against those of us who do legitimate ripping for our own personal use.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, because like I was saying on the list, what I do is that I like to make exercise CDs and tapes. And I don't sell them. I don't give them to people. I make them for my own personal use.
Yep.
And when I'm on that treadmill, I want some boogie and music, because
quite right.
It's the only way I can deal with the treadmill.
Yeah.
So, I mean, talking books just don't do it for the treadmill. I need
they don't.
Good music with a good beat, you know?
Yeah, we got a
70s. I collect music for that purpose.
Yep. We got a 70s disco channel on our satellite system, and I put that on when I'm boogieing on the Strider machine. But you're right. And from what I can gather, the protection of CDs that prevents you from making legitimate copies for your personal use could even be technically in violation of US copyright law. I don't know enough about that to be sure. But it's crazy, and it's surely a good way in how to lose friends and not influence people.
Right, and you know, when you have these copy-protected CDs, this is like, for hackers, this is a wonderful thing, because what they do is sit down and dismantle it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure they drool over this stuff.
Yeah, it won't take them long. Yeah.
So.
Well, good thoughts, and I'm gonna try and hold that thought for next week about the definition of disability in the context of NFB philosophy, because it's a really good philosophical discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Lovely to hear from you.
Okay, well, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Bye.
Okay, bye now. And that concludes another Blind Line. Back next week with more. And don't forget that tomorrow, the Snowman and Dennis Miller are along, and they'll be doing Miller Time. And then after that, you can hear the new program with Jim Snowbiker and Mike Bullis. And I'm sure that that promises to be fun. All happening tomorrow on ACB Radio Mainstream, the talk of the blind community. I'm out of here with Hoyt Axton. I'm going to go and enjoy some lovely sunshine. See you next week.
It was Della and a dealer and a dog named Jake and a cat named Kalamazoo. Left the city in a pickup truck, gonna make some dreams come true. Yeah, they rolled out west where the wild sun sets and the coyote bays at the moon. Della and the dealer and a dog named Jake and a cat named Kalamazoo. That cat can talk, what tales he tell about Della and the dealer and the dog as well. But the cat was cool and he never said a mumbling word. Down Tucson way there's a small cafe where they play a little cowboy tune. And the guitar picker was a friend of mine by the name of Randy Boone. Yeah, Randy played her a sweet love song and Della got a fire in her eyes. The dealer had a knife and the dog had a gun and the cat had a shot of rye. That cat could talk, what tales he tell about Della and the dealer and the dog as well. But the cat was cool and he never said a mumbling word. Yeah, the dealer was a killer, he was evil and mean, and he was jealous of the fire in her eyes. He snorted his coat, threw a century note, and he swore that Boone would die. And the stage was set when the lights went out, there was death in Tucson town. Two shadows ran for the far back door, and one stayed on the ground. If that cat could talk, what tales he'd tell about Della and the dealer and the dog as well. But the cat was cool, and he never said a mumbling word. Shadows ran from the bar that night, and a dog and a cat ran too. And the tires got hot on the pickup truck as down the road they flew. It was Della and her lover and a dog named Jake and a cat named Kalamazoo. Left Tucson in a pickup truck, gonna make some dreams come true. Yeah, yeah.